What's up for grabs right now, honestly, is the Democratic Party a viable party for this country?
Hello, and welcome back to Party Time, a mini-series from 538 looking at where Democrats and Republicans are headed in the Trump era. I'm Galen Druk, podcast producer and reporter.
And I'm politics reporter Claire Malone. Each week in February, we're talking to lawmakers, strategists, and stakeholders from different viewpoints within the two major parties.
So far, in our first two episodes, we talked to Trump allies and Trump skeptics in the GOP. And now we are shifting across the aisle to talk to Democrats. And this week in particular, we're talking to the progressive wing of the party.
We've seen our party come to the table with the most milquetoast propositions and walk away with something that makes no one happy.
Where we failed as a party is to fully understand the economic anxiety that the American people were feeling.
No, I don't think the progressive wing should and will compromise with the neoliberal Democrats.
All right, Galen, are you ready to dive into the Democratic Party?
Yeah, let's do this.
Okay. Before we listen to some of our conversations, our politics editor, Micah Cohen, is here to talk about where the party stands right now. Hey, Micah.
Hey, Claire. Galen, thanks for having me again.
So this is a question that probably needs, I don't know, several books and some time and space to answer. But on a rudimentary level, how did the 2016 election change things for Democrats?
I think it changed everything, and I think it changed nothing. Look, the 2016 election for most Democrats was a huge shock. No one expected, certainly if you were on the Clinton side of the aisle, nobody expected Trump to win. And so Democrats are left, after they sort of picked themselves off the ground, wondering, what the hell went wrong? And that's the moment we're in now, where Democrats are asking that question, where they're starting to answer that question, but we're starting to get a lot of different answers, and we're still figuring that out.
But the Democrats' decline didn't come out of nowhere, right? They've been losing power basically since they got it.
That's right. So, you know, that's the change nothing part. You know, 80,000 votes in three states go a different way, and Hillary Clinton is in the White House right now. But even if she were in the White House, that probably would not have changed the fact that essentially ever since Obama got into office, and this is not me putting this on Obama, but that's the timeline, Democrats have been losing seats in the House, in the Senate. They've been losing governor's mansions. They've been losing state legislative seats. They have just been receding. Their power is really limited to the coast now. And that would be the case whether Hillary Clinton was in the White House or not.
And so now that Democrats are where they are, what do you see as the key questions that they're asking as a party?
Yeah, that's a really good question. The big question is basically, what questions should they ask? So on the one hand, Democrats are asking, was there something wrong with our message? Should we have pushed a more economic-focused, more populist-focused message to appeal to these white voters with less education in the Midwest? Would that have helped? On the other hand, there are Democrats asking, does this boil down to a logistical problem? Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. Should our plan be to win governor's races, win state legislative seats, so that in 2020, when the census comes up, we can redraw all these maps? Where Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren would probably say, hey, we have a message problem. We're not appealing to these voters. Chuck Schumer might say, no, this is really about nuts and bolts politics, and we need to get better at getting our message out, but the platform of the Democratic Party is fine.
Do we have any sense at this point where they're going to end up?
Yeah, I don't. And keep in mind, right, it could be neither of those things. But I think it is safe to say that the more progressive wing of the party will push for a more populist economic message. The establishment wing of the party seems likely to push more towards the status quo, frankly, right? That's part of being in the establishment, is liking that you're in the establishment. So I don't think we know yet, this is part of why we wanted to do this series, how these wings will shake out or what they will push for, but it'll be really interesting to watch.
As Micah said, the main divide is progressive versus establishment. And we're speaking with both wings over the next 2 weeks, starting with progressives.
And this week's lineup includes Representative Raul Grijalva, who's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. There's Roseanne DeMauro, who is the executive director of National Nurses United. And we also have Jen Kaufman, and she's senior vice president of Revolution Messaging. And that's the strategy firm that did Bernie Sanders' digital strategy in 2016.
And first up is Roseanne DeMauro, executive director of National Nurses United, as you said, Galen, which is the largest union of registered nurses in the country. It was also the first national labor union to endorse Bernie Sanders for the Democratic nomination.
And we began by asking who she's backing in the race for DNC chair.
We're absolutely 100% with Keith Ellison. We think he represents the future of the party. And we think in the absence of someone like Keith Ellison, that the party remains in the status quo. The right wing basically stays entrenched and the Democrats continue to lose. What's up for grabs right now, honestly, is the Democratic Party a viable party for this country? Keith is emblematic of what a different future looks like. His being in the race basically challenges the status quo. And they are doing, it's the last gasp. It's the death rattle. I mean, and if you're anywhere on social media, you see how irrelevant and out of touch the Clintonites are and the Clinton followers are. I assume that for some of the Democrats, it'll be easier to defect to the right than it will be to go with Keith Ellison, Bernie Sanders' agenda, because ultimately they're beholden to their funders. They're looking at their future. They're looking for their cush jobs following their political days. They're lazy. They haven't been out among the people. They haven't taken the country seriously. They deserve to lose this race.
I read you recently quoted saying that the DNC chair is, quote, truly emblematic of the division within the Democrats. If the Democratic Party rejects the Sanders base, it will be at their extreme peril.
It will.
So I'm wondering, what is the division that you see within the party on a specific level?
On a very specific level, what we're talking about is a market versus a society. And where the Democrats and the Republicans have rested is on basically making our country a marketplace for profit. And what the Sanders, Ellison, our politics basically are a very different vision for this country. So ultimately, here's where I think the wager is at this point in time. The Democrats are trying very hard to return to a neoliberal agenda. It's not about a vision for this country. It's not about making this country better. The Democrats had a majority in Congress. They had the president, and they did very little. They didn't enact single payer. They didn't clean up the climate. They didn't fight for free education or tuition-free education. They did the minimum they could do to be able to act in their pious way. And what you saw reflected in the election was that people thought they were elitist insiders. And you know what? They were right. That's exactly who they are.
Progressives have been seen for a long time as sort of being the underdogs. But I'm wondering if the progressive wing of the party is looking to really take center stage. Do you think it has to change tactics? In other words, be more small C Catholic with the rest of the party and sort of make compromises that it hasn't had to before?
Well, what you see, I think, in the Senate at this point in time is clearly Bernie Sanders. Well, in Washington, D.C., everyone's behind Bernie Sanders. They're doing it for nefarious reasons, from my perspective. I don't know, nefarious is a heavy word, but they're doing it it's wrong-spirited. They're betting that Bernie can discredit Trump. And counting on Trump's failure is extremely reckless. And so the progressive wing, no, I don't think the progressive wing should and will compromise with the neoliberal Democrats. I don't, because mm-hmm. they can't and maintain credibility. That credibility will be lost and the votes will continue going to the right.
So you don't see it as speaking to the centrists, we absolve you of your sins. This is, you know, our reconciliation. You guys still think that you need to be almost adversarial with the.
We're not going to compromise. You know, I can say this entirely based upon my own organization and social media. There are no compromises with conservatives when it comes to the humanity of this country. That's happened. That's gone. That's been the last 50 years. I mean, and then moving into the neoliberal agenda, it was cynical. It was absolutely cynical because the greatest economic inequality happened under, you know, the last decades. And the country is in a downward spiral. The jobs are gone. Hope is gone.
Listening to you describe how absolute you think the pivot should be for the Democratic Party, look, like, Hillary Clinton still won the primary by 4 million votes and ended up winning the popular vote in the national election by close to 3 million. I mean, do you think that people's views or Democrats' views in this country have pivoted to the extent that you're describing them?
You know what? You can say what you want. The mythology about Clinton winning this election, 50% of the people didn't vote for either one of these candidates, and 25% of those who did voted against her. 75% of the people who were not with her. You cannot say that she was a bona fide leader any more than you can say that for Trump for the most part.
I don't want to make this about Hillary Clinton so much as the other aspects of the Democratic Party, because clearly the entire Democratic Party is not progressive, right? Ultimately, whatever the Democratic Party becomes, it wants to win national elections. It wants to win statewide elections. So do you see a world in which the progressive movement becomes the majority of the Democratic Party?
It could happen so easily. That's the thing. I mean, ultimately, the progressives could take this party and they could win this country very quickly. And how I know that is by being on the ground with Sanders and watching someone who came from nowhere, I think this guy from Vermont, came from nowhere and building the kind of passion and populism and seeing the hope. The generation that matters is the generation that was with Sanders, because they're going to be the voters of tomorrow, right? So there's a longing for that. What I was the most amazed about, actually, in the campaign was watching kind of the younger generation and how they work from a collectivist model rather than like my generation, which was very individualistic, right? It's almost like this built-in socialism with the younger generation. They actually pool together, they work together, they work as a unit. It's impressive.
What does a progressive movement need to do on a very concrete level to win over more supporters? And I'm wondering, are there specific parts of the country you guys want to target? And are there specific policy issues that you think you're really going to win on, going beyond just the broad economic message of fairness? I mean, what specifically do you think people are really looking for from this movement?
First of all, I don't talk in terms of broad, like, fairness. That's party speak. What we're talking about are very specifics. We're talking about an infrastructure that's built in this country and a distribution of money that's actually more equitable, frankly, where the 1% doesn't get to have everything, where every person actually in this country does have an opportunity, where there isn't racism, that basically there's laws and there's enforcement of those laws that doesn't allow that. And the people get to live with dignity in a way that actually gives them jobs, provides national health care, which this country should have, where education is tuition free, where people should be able to aspire in America in all ways. So we're looking for very, very specifics that basically invest in the people of this country and take some of the money from Wall Street and reinvest it in this country. The vulgarity of both of these parties is that they've allowed Wall Street to just basically take it all. I'm not a political scientist. I'm not looking at swing states or this state or that state. I'm looking at this country.
Sure. You brought up racial equality. And I think one thing that people did point out earlier on in Bernie Sanders' campaign is that he was slower to pick up minority voters. There has been, I think, a little bit of a weakness of really attracting a substantial number of minority voters to the progressive movement. And I'm wondering what steps will be taken in the next couple of years to change that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's what you see under Sanders is kind of this broad-based coalition where people are coming together from all the various groups. He's obviously leading the movement in the country. And how he's leading that movement is by co-joining the movements, including, you know, the immigrants' rights movement, you know, Black Lives Matter, everything. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, I think there's far more focus. I think it was actually a very healthy campaign insofar as we saw where people didn't feel that they were a part of something. But I also thought on the other side, obviously, there was a cynicism with respect to minority communities that they just assumed that that would go to Clinton. But I think that what we learned is that we have to be more cognizant of what our language is, how we include people everywhere for a populist-based movement.
Obviously, you're a Bernie Sanders supporter. But are there any, you know, we're talking about death rattle and there needs to be a new way. Are there any young people, like name names here, are there any young union leaders or organizers or progressive legislators throughout the states?
Well, yeah, I think there are some good legislators. I think, you know, we're looking at like Gavin Newsom in California, who's lieutenant governor. He's the guy when he was the mayor of San Francisco, and he's bold. He was the first one. He was on the cutting edge in terms of gay and lesbian rights. He was bold, and he didn't listen to the numbness of the Democratic Party. He took risk, he took chances, and he's going to end up leading California in the next as the next governor. But in terms of the overall legislature in Washington, D.C., it's really hard to know. It's really hard to know. You know, we used to like really, Barbara Lee was just amazing in her, yeah, I mean, she really was. But, you know, I ended up in, even in a kind of adversarial positioning with Barbara Lee, who tried to say that the ACA was an acceptable alternative to single payer, which it's not, because it leaves so many people harmed. Roseanne, and she knows it. She knows it. I mean, so the question, and I use Barbara Lee as an example, because how many good people are in hiding because of what the Clintons actually did to this country?
Donald Trump has been elected. And I'm wondering, you know, I ran into a lot of people in the past few months who had voted for Sanders in the primary and ended up voting for Trump. And so I'm wondering what you as a progressive leader think about this question, which is there anything that Donald Trump is or embodies that is good for progressive causes or good for labor?
Yes, and I think it's really a mistake that people don't give this guy his due on, first of all, on trade. I mean, he was in the same place we were on the TPP. And yet, you know, look, the Democrats are hoping to regain their power by being anti-Trump. They're not articulating a vision for America. The Democratic Party is now this Trump-centric, has a Trump-centric narrative that they think is going to regain them power. It's not. So, yes, so he was better on trade. Actually, he initially articulated a position on single payer that I haven't heard the Democrats articulate for a very long time. And in fact, when we were fighting with the DNC, when they thought Clinton had it in the bag and they were so arrogant, they rejected single payer. They thought they had this election locked down by 11%. And yet they still, she said, it will never, ever happen. You know what happened? She didn't. And it's because of that attitude.
You know, you're speaking again about like the DNC and more establishment Democrats. But I mean, do you see Trump as an ally to labor in this country?
No, Trump's not going to be an ally to labor. Trump's going to be an ally to himself. Let's be real. Trump's an ally to labor. It depends. I mean, I think Trump, everything to Trump is instrumental value. Does it work for Donald Trump, right? You know, we're not Trump obsessed. You know, if Trump does something good, we're going to acknowledge. I do on my Twitter site. I acknowledge, you know, his the TPP stuff. And I'm hoping, I'd like to see, I think the greatest gift that Trump could do is to actually enact single payer, because that would actually embarrass both parties as they need to be embarrassed.
Are you worried about anything specifically when it comes to Trump?
Very worried about Trump. I'm worried about Trump and economic inequality, greater economic inequality. I'm worried about racism. I'm worried about his base and racism, because I think that a lot of the campaign gave voice to that. And I'm worried about his positioning on the labor movement. He says he's pro-worker. But you know, is he anti-union? I don't know. I mean, he just signed a 4-year deal with, Unite Here in Las Vegas. So I'm hoping that he actually has sense enough not to try to harm organized labor, but he shouldn't.
Claire, it's pretty clear that there are parts of the Democratic Party on the left that are upset about how things shook out in 2016 and are not ready to make nice with the Democratic establishment as it stands.
Yeah, I went to the DNC forum last weekend in Baltimore, and it's certainly clear that the party is trying to figure out how to come together and appease some of that anger on the left. At the forum with all the speakers, there was one applause line where they said, "We need to heal the anger that Bernie Sanders supporters are feeling." And I saw these two women wearing Keith Ellison shirts stand up and applaud. They were obviously Bernie Sanders supporters during the primary. And then the person talking said, "And we need to feel the pain of the Hillary Clinton supporters and what they're going through." And the two women immediately sat down. So to me, it was sort of this perfect example of there are a lot of people whose passions are still really aroused by this.
Yeah. You know, when we spoke with Roseanne, she also expressed a little bit of surprise that we had reached out to her, in the sense that the left within the party had been sort of neglected, not just by the establishment, by the media, and they're feeling, you know, maybe a little bit of what Trump supporters actually felt. But when it comes to the strategy moving forward, there remains this question of whether or not there are enough progressives within the Democratic Party, and then whether or not the country on the whole is progressive enough to make that a winning coalition, right? And to be fair, from the polling that we have, it looks like Democrats are becoming more progressive.
One of Roseanne's points actually about young people being the future of the party, which is a thing that a lot of people like to say these days. This is something that I talked about during the election, but younger people have fewer negative associations with socialism or things that are branded as socialism in the U.S. That Cold War dynamic had really fallen away by the time a lot of millennials were coming of age politically.
And I think the one other constituency within the Democratic coalition that Roseanne brought up and that we're going to be keeping our eyes on are union households, right? More union households voted for Trump than any Republican since Reagan. And I think that part of Roseanne's pitch is that she has a message that is attractive to union households. And if Democrats are going to hold those union households, the progressive wing of the party is going to play a big role in it.
Yeah.
Okay. So next up is Jen Kaufman of Revolution Messaging. But first, a word from this week's sponsor. This week's episode of Party Time is brought to you by 1-800-Flowers.com. You know what's always in season? Surprising a friend or a loved one with a bouquet from 1-800-Flowers.com. Just think how great you'll make them feel with vibrant roses or other seasonal favorites. 1-800-Flowers are perfect for any occasion, like anniversaries, birthdays, or even making your friend or loved one's day just because. 1-800-Flowers has a wide selection of beautiful bouquets and arrangements. And the best part is, they start at just $29.99. 1-800-Flowers picks your roses, tulips, lilies, and more at their peak and ships them overnight to ensure freshness and your loved one's amazement. Simply pick your delivery date and let 1-800-Flowers handle the rest. Vibrant bouquets starting at just $29.99 is an amazing deal. Every bouquet is packed by 1-800-Flowers with a 100% smile guarantee. To get beautiful and vibrant bouquets starting at just $29.99, go to 1-800-Flowers.com, click the radio icon, and enter code PARTY. 1-800-Flowers.com, click that radio icon, and enter the code PARTY. And hey, the offer ends soon. Okay, we're back, and we had the chance to talk to Jen Kaufman. She's a senior vice president at Revolution Messaging, which, as we mentioned, did Bernie Sanders' digital strategy for the campaign. And she's previously worked with a number of labor organizations, and she even worked on internet strategy for Al Gore's campaign in 2000.
Did she invent it along with him?
Yes, I think so.
Good to know. We began the conversation by getting a sense of where she thinks the party should head in the wake of the 2016 election.
We see what happens when we don't connect with voters about why we're the party that's fighting for them. This election, so many people felt pessimistic. Many people thought that things aren't working. And you know, I see, you know, hats that say, oh, America's already great. And I'm a progressive, and I'm not sure that I always feel that way. I think that there's a lot of voter frustration, and we need to speak to that. And at the heart of that is economic inequality. At the heart of that is so much that Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and the like have been addressing. And, you know, we need to take a hard line. And it's hard for us to do that if we don't divorce ourselves from some of the ties that are preventing our party from moving forward and really tackling this head on. I'm lucky enough to have been able to buy a home. And when I was negotiating on the sales price, I didn't come in at the, you know, my highest price, right? I mean, I came in and I tried to negotiate. And I feel like that's what the progressives have been urging the Democratic Party to do. And I feel like so often in the past, we've seen our party come to the table with the most milquetoast propositions and walk away with something that makes no one happy. And I don't think that that's how we're going to win voters and move our agenda forward.
What lessons have you learned from the success of the Bernie Sanders campaign that you think could be applied more broadly?
Authenticity, I think, was the biggest takeaway. Authenticity permeated every aspect of the campaign, right? And I think that's perhaps a lot of what's driven the appeal on the Republican side behind Trump. There isn't this filter, right? When you saw Bernie Sanders and you saw his hair kind of blowing this way and that way, I mean, you knew there wasn't the stylist, this image maker. There wasn't this committee of people who determined, you know, what he was going to wear that day and, you know, what he was going to say that day. The way that the campaign was people powered, meaning that it was fueled by millions of people who gave small dollar donations. It was like $218 million, mostly through those small donations of an average of, you know, $27, that meant that the campaign and Bernie Sanders didn't have ties to special interests. And I think that was a really big takeaway. Authenticity really was the winner.
Was there a moment where Sanders really broke through? Was it a conscientious decision on the part of you guys to say, we're going to go everywhere, we're going to talk to everyone? I'm really wondering what it took to make, you know, Bernie Sanders is now just Bernie, but he wasn't a year ago, a year and a half ago. And so I'm wondering what it was.
You have to be issues focused. And I think that was how he was able to stand out from this field in which, you know, he had very little name recognition. In some ways, because he didn't have that name ID, he had to be for something. He had to define himself by his positions on income inequality and the system being rigged. You know, we had tremendous success early on advertising with on Facebook petitions urging people to sign on to a petition that would be sent to their governors stating their support for the, you know, refugees fleeing war torn Syria. And that does two things, right? It defines Bernie and the issues that he sides with, that he stands for. And it begins to form a movement, and it connects them with the issues that they care about and begins to build a narrative for what the country can look like and how we can move forward.
How does your experience from the campaign change the conventional wisdom about how to run a campaign moving forward, right? Ultimately, the candidate who had a pretty ad hoc strategy for much of the campaign and raised far fewer dollars than his opponent ended up winning.
One interesting thing that I think, you know, often wasn't reported enough about was, you know, modeling. And people talked about the models and the models being wrong. I would posit almost that we need to stop relying on models entirely. And it's not because whether they're right or wrong, but because models mean that we're going to reach out to people based off of past, like, voting behavior. These are audiences that are modeled after what likely voters look like. And, you know, we see here in the U.S. that we have, like, really abysmal turnout numbers. You know, at the high, maybe 50% of potential voters are turning out. At a low, like in local elections, it's like 20%. And I would posit that perhaps the reason why we're seeing those kind of numbers is because we're only talking to certain people. One of the huge successes behind the campaign was that we weren't heavily micro-targeting. We were talking really broadly, and we were talking to audiences that in the past have not been communicated with by political campaigns. And people were hungry for it, and they really responded. And I think that's the path forward.
You've pulled a lot of triggers here for us when you say maybe we don't need models anymore, because we talk a lot about, you know, how campaigns have used data in the past even 10 years to move forward. Are you saying, hey, we're kind of mostly done with that? Is there room for maybe a different kind of model, a rethinking of models?
Yeah, the model also, like, is based off of past cycles, and there hasn't been someone like Trump in cycles past, right? So, so you know, the model might have been right if the candidate opposite Hillary Clinton had been anybody but Trump. I do need to step back. You know, my dad has a PhD in, you know, statistics and would kill me if I were to say, you know, throw out all the models, right? But, you know, I think the reality is that we need to be smarter about targeting. And I think to hold up the model as this idol, you know, I mean, there are really cool things that you can do with micro-targeting. You can have, you know, messages that are tweaked, you know, for specific audiences. And that's really cool. Like, me as a digital user, I like it when I get a message that's created just for me. You know, I'm a Latina whose last name is Kaufman. And when I get something that's in Spanglish, that's perfect. That's right at, like, the nexus of the story of an essence of who I am. That's really cool for me. So we can do really awesome things like that when we're smart about using models and data to target. I think, though, to only target people who are within those universes is the big mistake. And you can't have such unique siloed messages that only go to certain people and certain audiences, because then I think that undercuts the authenticity. We've seen that, you know, authenticity is king. It's just so important to voters these days.
I think this is perhaps an uncomfortable question for a lot of Democrats, but do you think the Democratic Party was too top heavy on cultural issues and not paying enough attention to core economic messaging? And tied into that, how does the party balance civil rights issues, gay rights issues, while also maybe trying to put the pedal to the metal on appealing to the working class that in some places, black or white, doesn't share certain progressive cultural values?
That's a really good question. And I do think it's possible to be focused on both economic and cultural issues at the same time. I think from a strategic standpoint, putting on my strategist hat, I would say perhaps one of the mistakes was in not focusing on our frame and moving it forward, mm-hmm. and instead constantly being distracted by Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And I think that those distractions prevented us from being able to shine a bright enough light on our economic message. You know, he would tweet about something, then everybody would get up in arms and they would respond back. And it felt like the news cycle was just kind of wash, rinse, and repeat. Sure. You know, every 24 hours, there was something crazy that he would say, everybody would respond to it. And I think at the end of the day, I mean, a lot of people, you know, even sometimes I said, oh, I wish Hillary Clinton would have had a better economic message. In the end, you know, she had an economic message. I think it didn't cut through. And I think that part of that was because everyone, me included, we were all too focused in responding to Donald Trump's Trumpster fires, as you know, we were referring to them. But more than that, it also meant that more resources needed to be devoted to cutting through the noise by like promoting social media content, by, you know, having more digital advertising to cut through that echo chamber, to cut through the noise and deliver that economic message, you know, along with cultural messages to voters.
I know you've worked with a number of labor groups. Labor has sort of been on a decade-long decline as far as power. A lot of labor households voted Trump this year. And I'm wondering, what is the future of the labor movement within the Democratic Party?
One thing that's going to be key is letting union members know what's happening. Donald Trump had talked about draining the swamp, and he's turned around and he wants to stack his cabinet with picks from Goldman Sachs and Exxon, and to stack the cabinet with Washington and Wall Street insiders is the opposite of draining the swamp. And I think for union members, they're going to be really concerned when they connect the dots and realize what's happening. With regard to kind of where does labor go from here, it's a really interesting question. And it's something that the labor movement has been, you know, asking themselves. We're seeing them redefining what it means to be in the labor movement. You know, do you work? Then yes, if you work, you are part of the labor movement. You know, work has value, and that means you're part of this movement and part of what makes America great.
So Galen, issues and authenticity.
Issues and authenticity, right? Who'da thunk it? No. But seriously, on one hand, she seemed to agree with Roseanne, right? That the party spent too much time responding to Trump and not enough time on its own message. But on the other hand, she did say that Clinton had an economic message. And the fact of the matter is that Clinton adopted several key Sanders policies like an ACA public option, anti-TPP, more help with tuition, things like that. So on some level, it's not just going to be policies that win elections going forward for the Democrats, if they do, in fact, win elections going forward. It's also going to be the strategy, right? Because if nobody hears your message, it doesn't matter what your message is.
Strategy, man. It's everything. But yeah, that's a question for the Democrats going forward, which is how much they're going to make their identity about opposing Trump and how much they're going to make it about the issues, a vision for the country, all that good stuff. The leadership in Congress is certainly opposing Trump, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi. But then you've got figures like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, who are a little bit more the folk heroes. And they're out there talking about rural poverty and health care in a way that people like and people sort of seem to really seek out. So it'll be interesting to see who becomes those Democratic leaders that are really sort of seen as the big opposition to Trump.
Also, shout out to Jen for blatantly advocating throwing out the model in an interview with 538.
We see
props
you, Jen.
For that. We see you. But yeah, so what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, every election we read all about how campaigns are using data and they're using all this fancy modeling. And it wouldn't be surprising to me if the Democrats sort of downplay that data-centric angle that the Clinton campaign really did kind of get caught up with, or at least purportedly so, in the narrative that has spun out after the election. It wouldn't be surprising to me if they focus more on the we're getting out there and talking to people in their communities at the municipal level and really trying to figure out what people want from us.
Yeah, I mean, Democrats got really excited about the Obama campaign's use of data, but that's like not the only takeaway from the campaign. Yeah, they had the data, but they also had the hope and change and no red or blue America, we're all united, vision for the country that is separate from data.
Yeah, the guy was a good talker. Okay, our last conversation is with Representative Raul Grijalva of Arizona's 3rd District, and he's the co-chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, and he was the first member of Congress to endorse a guy named Bernie Sanders in the Democratic primary.
Indeed, and we started off, of course, by asking him who he's supporting for DNC chair and why.
I'm supporting Keith Ellison. He's a good friend. He's been co-chair with me for the last, including this session, three sessions of Progressive Caucus. I feel he would be a very, very significant change agent to the DNC. The main point would be to empower our party at the local level to do good quality candidate recruitment, starting from school boards to city councils to state legislators. So it's not a top-down system, and kind of reflective of the mood of the voters at this time, that they want people to fight for them right now. Democrats do, and I think more and more of the country is coming to that conclusion given what we're seeing from the Trump administration. And Keith is, to me, the kind of voice and intensity that our party needs very badly.
You know, the Democrats are obviously going through a certain period of time, and as the party sort of picks up its pieces, what do you think the main goal should be going forward? Maybe a couple of specifics as far as what the policy goals should be and what the messaging goals should be.
You know, I went to the Progressive Caucus Summit, and then a week after that, I also attended the Democratic Caucus. And let me talk about some similarities. The similarities were that, you know, at this point in history, the Democrats feel very strongly that they have to be the voice for the American people. And like as reflective as we are of the American people, we have our philosophical differences as a party. But I think the issue here is that our fight is to defend democracy and the constituencies across this country that democracy protects.
Can I ask you a little bit about the unity question, though? Because we've talked to some progressive grassroots activists who are still very angry at the Democratic Party. I was also at the meeting this weekend in Baltimore, and I certainly saw some obvious anger at some of the structures of the Democratic Party, about superdelegates, about the primary system itself.
Yeah, and those things all have to change, and part of the reform is going to happen with who the leadership is of the DNC. It behooves our party to listen to what happened in that primary season. Yes, focus on why and do all the autopsies and everything that people are doing as to why Hillary lost. The failure was turnout. The failure was not enough of our base constituency turning out to vote. That's where we lost the election. And this is where I think we failed as a party, is to fully understand the economic job insecurity, anxiety that the American people were feeling. And not being able to articulate that and not being able to share that, I think, is what causes the problem. Bernie's strength came from a very strong populist economic point of view, in which I supported Bernie. But the point being now, that's a lesson to have been learned, and I hope, and I think my colleagues are understanding that.
Like Claire said, we've spoken with progressives who are pretty angry still at the party establishment. So what do you think the party establishment needs to do to get along with the progressive wing that is skeptical right now?
Break the mold. Break the mold that has been both the campaign mold and the policy mold for decades.
I mean, are there specific changes you think they could make?
Or issues?
It's fully on issues and on people and on individuals, organizations, to fully integrate them into what the strategy is, what the overall issue message is going to be, so that, you know, people feel that they're part of the battle. Mm-hmm. And I think that's imperative that that get done. The other thing is to understand that in the rarefied air of Washington, D.C., everybody's a leader. But the fact remains that sometimes those of us that have the privilege of being in the House of Representatives and being elected here have to understand that at some points we're also followers. We lend voice to those issues, but we're also followers. And I think we've got to get that into our mindset that, you know, much of what's happening organically across this country needs our support. We have to be there, lend voice to it, but also understand that it's got a life of its own. And so sometimes we follow, and we got to get used to that.
Do you think that the party establishment has the same perspective, that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are ready to kind of take the lead from the protest movement?
I don't think you can pick up the flag and run in front right now. I think that we're going to earn our place in the resistance by what we do in the next 2 or 3 months as a caucus and as Democrats, by showing unity, by providing alternatives to the American people, to the foolishness we're going to see in the House and the Senate, and by being a very vocal and public pushback on Trump. doing those things, I think, begins to reassure the American people that we're fighting for them. Running to the front of the march without doing that homework, I don't think it's going to work for us.
A lot of people are drawing comparisons to the Tea Party, but the Tea Party did have organizations that stepped in and tried to direct things. Do you think this progressive passion faces any challenge as far as maybe not directing it down the right pipelines of electoral?
No, I think the electoral will become part of it, whether that's the intended reaction or not. In 2 years, I think that's a bellwether election, okay, a huge election. And I would suggest that as everybody continues to organize at the community level, that all that at some point is going to turn and focus to the electoral politics that are coming around the bend. And so I don't think there's room to sit it out or to be so pure that you can't get your hands dirty in electoral politics or vote. I think so much is at risk now that I think it'll have its own natural conclusion, and it will affect the election.
You've been talking about the grassroots taking a leadership position in where the Democratic Party moves going forward. But ultimately, the leadership of the party that's getting up every day in front of Congress and expressing Democratic points of view are still Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Do you think that the leadership actually needs to change in order to bring the party in the direction that you're describing?
No, I don't. And let me tell you why. I mean, we went through that process of change, and Nancy was elected again to be the leader for the Democrats. And going into the fight that we're going into, and she's been in the fights before, and at this point, you know, us going through another self-flagellation to try to figure out where we should be in terms of leadership, I don't think it serves a purpose. I think Nancy will be there because that's where the caucus is going to be. It's the members of the caucus that are going to drive leadership, and leadership, I think, is right now. I don't have a complaint to say Nancy's not doing what she should be doing. She is trying to get us into a position where we're more unified, and being unified, understand the urgency, and giving people room, progressive rooms, to be able to show their leadership as well. I think right now it's self-defeating to get ourselves into a whole discussion about who should be or shouldn't be. That train already passed, and we deal with what we have. And I've been in fights with Nancy before, and I'm comfortable. I think she's a fighter.
Yeah. So we're talking from the perspective that the progressive agenda is going to be the path forward for the Democratic Party. But I think it's maybe worth questioning that. So what are the indications that you see that tell you it's obvious that the direction of the party should be towards the progressive agenda?
The freshmen that joined the progressive caucus coming from all over the country, progressives that survived in their districts, even though Trump won them by 20, 18, 15 points, and they won their election as well. That tells me that there is, with the economic message and with the social justice message, you know, for too long we've tried to sanitize those issues so that we can win a majority. I think what's happened now is the understanding by all that that's what's resonating, that's what people believe, and that's what they're waiting to hear. So I think it's changed the whole tone.
You brought up social justice and the economy. And one of the questions for Democrats right now is Democrats were in some ways accused of being too heavy on cultural issues during the past election and not getting their economic message across to voters enough. Where do you think that balance lies?
Well, I don't think it's an either-or proposition. I mean, we have to accept two realities. That after the recession caused by bad tax breaks and ugly tax code and no regulation over Wall Street, after that recession, some people did not recover. And that economic reality is there. The wage disparity is there. And that all gets addressed. But it's not an either-or proposition. You know, you just have to look around you and understand fully that the face of America is changing and will continue to change. Now, does that become something that we need to be afraid of? No. I don't think that contradicts the economic. People of color, women, are also workers. And so I don't think it, for me, the economic theory is the most non-categorical in terms of race or something else or gender of all the issues that we deal with. So I don't see it as an either or.
I mean, to me, it seems from talking to a lot of people, it sounds like the Democrats want to hit that progressive economic message a lot harder than they do the progressive cultural message, and I think we're talking here about, you know, guns and abortion, things like that, because as you said before, there were places where Trump had an appeal and Bernie Sanders had an appeal. In other words, that more populist that more populist economic message seems to be the thing that people are talking about a whole lot more.
I understand the argument. I don't subscribe to it, okay? Because like I told you earlier, I don't think it's an either-or proposition. In the sense that, you know, if we are going to build and sustain a coalition like we saw in the Women's March the day after the inauguration, as we saw in my hometown of Tucson, 15,000 people from all the rich variety of people that we have in our country, we have to not be afraid to deal with issues of immigration. We not be afraid to deal of issues that women are pushing. Those become those cultural, social, whatever you want to call them, issues. Build the coalition.
A lot of people have talked about how millennials are, you know, the future of the Democratic Party. They're more progressive. And I wanted to ask you about future leaders of the party, because right now the leaders of the Democratic Party are pretty old. Who are the people out there that you think are young progressive leaders?
I think there's plenty of them. And that's why the DNC chair is so important. It's profiling them, helping them, and doing the kind of technical and resource support that candidates need across this nation. Progressive candidates need across this nation. The fact that we have leadership that has been there for a long time is a criticism, and I realize that, and trying to accommodate that sometimes is a problem, because unfortunately people get set in their ways, and this is the cookie-cutter approach we used politically for all these elections. Now that we're pretty certain that that cookie-cutter approach is not going to work in the future elections, this is the opportunity to change all that. But you know, I think in the very near future, the leadership change that occurs will have to be leadership that's more tied to what we've been talking about. It's happening more than when I got here, but certainly not to my satisfaction, but I think it's coming.
Representative Grijalva is obviously a progressive politician in somewhat of the same vein as Roseanne DeMauro, but he's definitely portraying a more unified party than, for example, we heard from Roseanne. So I guess that's the kind of politician's take on where progressive politics stand.
Yeah. Politicians have to, in some ways, paint that glossy, unified front, right? They've kind of got to give the aspirational thing for the members of the party to get behind. And I think what it is glossing over is some very real anger, but also some very real energy from the progressive grassroots. And I think the Democrats, you know, he talked about this, the Democrats have to find a way to channel this energy. And I think what they're facing right now is, what's the best way to do that?
And kind of the way he put it was, let's let the grassroots lead this movement. And that sounds nice, and it's kind of a romantic view of politics. But at the end of the day, we've talked about how Americans for Prosperity and Freedom Works played a real role in organizing the Tea Party. Do progressives and Democrats need someone like that, or can really millions of protesters, resistors, dissenters, whatever you want to call them, lead the party?
It's an interesting question, and I've been talking to a lot of state party leaders and DNC voters for a piece that I'm working on about this DNC chair race. And what you heard a lot at this DNC forum in Baltimore were these people running for DNC chair saying, we need to listen more to the people at the state level. But what they meant was often the state party leaders, right? So they want more feedback from the bottom up, to hear from their state party organizations, not necessarily the progressive grassroots movements. They want to hear, who are your candidates and how can we help support them? How can we give you, you know, more money to make sure your technology is up to date? Stuff like that. It's less the idea of, how do we channel all these progressive movements into our party?
Mm-hmm.
But they're obviously a very important sort of side piece to the Democrats.
Yeah. And we will, of course, hear how establishment Democrats are responding to the progressive wing of the party next week. And here's a preview.
President Trump is the legitimate president of the United States. That's clear. But when you say the party is in the wilderness, the party got more votes than the other party.
My own view is that a lot of what's happened in the last couple of election cycles is more anti-incumbent than ideological.
That's for next Thursday. More party time. I'm Claire Malone.
And I'm Galen Droop. Micah Cohen is our insert flattering adjective here politics editor. Jody Avergan and Chadwick Matlin are our podcast editors. Jorge Estrada and Christine Laskowski are in the control room, and Kara Chin is our intern. Production help this week from Denise Guerra and Alyssa Jong Perry.
Get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments.
There's more information about this series and a partial transcript on our website, 538.com/podcasts. And if you missed last week's episode, you can find it there as well.
If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or a review in iTunes. When you leave a rating, it helps our rankings, which helps others discover the show.
And we'll see you next week for more Party Time!